Welcome to Sophisticated Property Investing, a podcast brought to you by Ethical Property Partners, the experts in sophisticated property investment.
Hello, this is Pete. I am one of the content producers here at Ethical Property Partners. As well as the podcast, we have our YouTube channel, and one thing that's been working brilliantly over there are our Sophisticated Saturdays. Now, this episode includes audio from a Sophisticated Saturday show where you'll hear about a deal that Frank has recently done. In the first part, you'll get all the numbers, so if you want to take part and work out how you'd do the deal, you can grab a calculator and make some notes before listening to the second part, where Frank will tell you exactly how he structured the deal in a sophisticated way. The third and final part is exclusive to you as a podcast listener, where Frank gets grilled by an expert investor and chats about the deal in more detail. So over to Frank.
This is a deal I did a few years ago now. So I was introduced to a couple actually from our congregation at church. And you might think, oh, Frank, you do a lot of deals with people from your church. Yeah, I do actually. But I also do deals with people from our kids' school, from our social clubs, etc. And the reason for that is I'm always talking about how I can buy houses, how I can help people that are struggling to sell their houses. So my circle of contacts know that I am someone to come to if they have a problem with property. And if you don't have contacts and referrals coming to you regularly asking you to help them with their property problems, then that's probably the missing ingredient. They don't know that you can help them. And so this is how this one came about. This couple were introduced to me by one of our leaders in our church, actually, who said, look, Frank might be able to help you. And they phoned up and they said, look, we've tried to sell this property twice and each time it's failed. The buyers have failed to get their mortgage on it. So they'd had an offer of £110,000 for this three-bedroom. It's an unusual property. It's a Muse property. So it's a two-bedroom house, semi-detached house, but not in the normal sense of the word. It's a converted stable, architect converted actually, so really well done. This is in the East Midlands a few years ago, and they were selling it on the open market and had an offer of £110,000. Now, the first time buyer that was buying it, beautiful house in probably the worst part of the city. It was right off the worst street in the city by a country mile. So that's where all the people would queue up waiting to get their drugs from the drug dealers of an evening. When it actually got to night time, the ladies of the night would come out and would ply their trade. So really the worst part of town. But it was just off that street, just behind it. It's the old stables to the main houses that make up that worst street in the city. And the first time buyers that were trying to pay 110 for it, their mortgage got declined because it was deemed not to be a residential area. And it's because the stables weren't, you know, a street. They were stables and this one had been converted. In fact, the one next door had also been converted. So that fell through. And then the next offer that was made was at 105,000, which they accepted. Also a first-time buyer. Of course, these are just going to NatWest and HSBC asking for mortgages, so nothing sophisticated at all about the lending that they're using. And that was also declined for the same reason. So this couple from my church, they were thinking that their property was unmortgageable, and it possibly was. I actually think I could have got a mortgage on it potentially, but certainly not easily and certainly not quickly. And because they thought it was unmortgageable, me saying, oh, I'll buy it with a mortgage, probably wasn't going to set the right tone, because two people had already failed. And if I did fail, which was entirely possible, then I'd lose all my credibility. So we needed a solution that hopefully avoided getting a mortgage. Now, they were putting it in an auction. They'd already had it valued by an auctioneer. An auctioneer said it will fetch between £73,000 and £75,000 in an auction. And they had resigned themselves to selling it for this. They were going to build a church down in the West Country, actually. And so they had resigned themselves to this at the point at which I was introduced to them. It was really well done out. It had high-end white goods still in it. Some of the furniture was still in it. Really nice property, great windows, underfloor heating. Yeah, really high spec property. It was probably an 8 out of 10 spec property in a 2 out of 10 area. So yeah, real oasis in a poor part of the city. And that is their situation. So what would you ask them? What would you need to find out? It's unencumbered, but they need the money to get down to Cornwall. They are just wanting a clean break. They're not sophisticated. They're not actually desperate. They've got no lending on it, etc. But they are wanting the headspace and they feel like they've got a real problem property now. What would you do? How would you structure it? After the break, I'll tell you how I did it.
This is the Sophisticated Property Investing Podcast. To see more about our Sophisticated Saturdays, just search YouTube for Ethical Property Partners.
And welcome back. So this is the part of the podcast where I explain how we actually did this deal. As I said, it's a few years ago now. So this is a completed deal that, interestingly, we've just refinanced. So what did we do? Well, first off, I offered them £75,000 for a swift and certain purchase, and they accepted. So they agreed to take it out of the auction, and I agreed to buy it in, I think I said 2 to 4 weeks, and we achieved that. I think we bought it in about 3 weeks. I decided not to go for conventional lending. I could have done because, you know, offers of 110, they're only needing 75. I could have perhaps got bridging, etc. But I decided to go for a private investor. So I went to a private investor who I asked to lend me £80,000 at quite a high interest rate. I offered them 8% interest, so quite a high interest rate. And I explained the situation. They were happy to help. I then gave the £75,000 to the couple that was selling. They were happy. They gave me the keys. And I used the £5,000 to furnish the property. Now, the reason I wanted to furnish it is because I didn't think that long-term tenants would stick around. I didn't think, you know, if I let it on an AST, a single tenancy, I didn't think tenants would stick around. Now, it had two private parking spaces that were right in front of the property. The property had a burglar alarm. We'd never had any crime associated with it. So it was in a really bad area. It was awful to drive through. Like, the curb appeal was non-existent, like whatever the opposite of curb appeal is, that's what it was. And so it was a really hard property, I think, for people to live in long term, especially being three bedrooms. That lends itself to a family, but this wasn't somewhere where you'd want your family, and it was done up too nice. So it would probably only have let for maybe £450 a month, something like that, as a single AST. So what I did is we rented it as a service accommodation unit. So it was brilliant for working professionals. We'd have people come for a month, sometimes 2 months, sometimes a little bit longer. We would have people come for weekends for weddings because, you know, three double bedrooms, that's six people, quite a lot. You know, it's quite a lot cheaper than staying in a hotel. We would have people come for events. We'd have parents and families come for graduations, etc. So a really wide spectrum of guests would come and use this property. Because of that, we had quite high occupancy and high monetization of this property. So before we paid the interest, this was bringing in between £800 and £1,000 a month, which is fantastic. So even after we were paying our interest on this, it was still making us a few hundred pounds a month, which is brilliant, given that it had none of my own money in the property. And I actually ran it like that for about 3 years, just over 3 years. Now, the investor then came back to me and said, look, Frank, that interest rate's been amazing, especially with interest rates at 0.1%. So I'm giving him 80 times his return on his money. So what he would get in the bank at 0.1%, we're giving him 80 times that return. So he's over the moon. In fact, he's done other deals with us since. But he said, actually, Frank, I could do with those funds back. And I said, no problem at all. I got the property revalued. It's just being revalued at £120,000. Interestingly, I tried it on the open market and we had a sale agreed at 145, which is amazing, but the purchaser couldn't get finance and I didn't want to mess around relisting it and trying to sell it again. So I decided just to refinance and hang on to it. And so we've got a refinance. I put the refinance through at 120 and it got that easily. We've got a RICS valuation of 120, and that means we're going to get lending of 90,000, which means that the property that cost me nothing to buy and has earned me a bit of money every month for the last 3 years, has now paid me £10,000 because I've got a mortgage of 90k, and has dropped down onto a much more reasonable interest rate. I think we're paying 3.8%, 4%, something like that interest. So a really low interest rate now on 90k. So the amount of money it's paying me per month has gone up even higher. And I've now got 10 grand in my pocket, which, you know, if you listen to the podcast regularly, you'll know that we source properties BNV for under £4,000 at a time. So that's another two BNV properties from that little bit of cashback, plus the ongoing residual positive cash flow. So a really neat deal, really small property, nothing risky about it, nothing out of the ordinary, but just an example of a no money down deal that that you can do day in, day out. So if you came up with that solution, congratulations. If you came up with a better solution, then brilliant. Do share it with us. You can pop it in the comments of our YouTube channel, or you can get in touch with us directly. And if you came up with a slightly inferior solution, then have a think about why. Why did you miss this? What was it that you missed, or what was it that what limiting beliefs got in the way?
Hi guys, I'm Amanda Jarvis-Dawn and I'm the master franchise owner for England and Wales. So Frank, I've listened to your sophisticated Saturday property challenge about buying a non-mortgageable property, and I'd like to quiz you and ask some of the questions that our audience would like to ask you. I found it fascinating. A lot of our listeners will probably be thinking that they would run a mile at buying a non-mortgageable property, but what is it about EPP systems that enable us to solve problems for vendors when most others would run a mile?
Our whole philosophy at EPP is about getting to know people. It's the fact that it's a people business, not a property business. And I think when you sit with someone for an hour, sometimes 2 hours, sometimes longer, and have a cup of tea or multiple cups of tea, you build a relationship that's unusual in this industry. I think this industry's really got a reputation, and I think it's probably deserved for being hard-nosed and focused on the numbers, etc. And so I think, A, we genuinely want to help the vendors, our vendors, and it's a partnership with them. And I often say that at the start of a transaction, you know, we're getting a good deal here and really want to buy the property, and you really want to sell the property to us. So we're now on the same side. Don't worry about what the solicitors say, that we're on opposite sides and that we're adversaries. We're actually in partnership now, and we're going to get this transaction through as smoothly as we can, as quickly as we can, etc. So I think that's the first thing. Secondly, I think it's a belief that we can actually solve any vendor's problem. And that might sound a bit arrogant, but after you've done hundreds of transactions and after you've helped your clients do countless transactions, that belief is there, that self-confidence. And then thirdly, it's actually having the resources to back that up and be able to complete on the deal quickly or come up with a solution that solves the vendor's problem and makes us money. And when I say resources, I mean knowledge. So understanding, we've got 62 strategies, you know, most people have got two or three maximum. And so having that toolbox of solutions, also having the time to invest in partner in the transactions, time to invest in the vendor, time to invest in chain chasing, because we strive for a win-win. We make good money on transactions, and that means that we can invest the time and the care in each individual transaction. It also means having the contacts, so the black book of professionals who are going to support the transaction through to a successful completion swiftly. And it's also the financial resources, so lenders or availability of cash or access to cash, etc., that is required for a transaction. So I think it's those three things combined, Amanda.
You've mentioned a few things there that I picked up on. So if I can just kind of go back to the deal, really. You explained you bought this mortgageable property. You've had it on serviced accommodation, so it's been giving you a great return. You've refinanced it and got cash back. And that just, in most people's eyes, just seems mind-boggling. I mean, to get cash back out of a deal that is already earning you really good cash flow is phenomenal. So you've mentioned here the little black book that we have. Is this where you find your the people to finance your deals. I mean, I know you've been involved in property for a long time. You've got a huge network. But if somebody was looking at this from a standing start, is that where you would start? Is that where you would steer people to go and have a look through their phone and their contacts to sort of have a look at who they might be able to have a conversation with?
Yeah, it's a chicken and egg conversation, isn't it? Do you go and find the money first? Do you go and find the potential finance investors? Do you go and get decisions in principle from mortgage lenders, bridging providers, etc.? Or do you go find a really good deal? For me, it's always the latter, because I think it's a bit of a cliche, but money will find a good deal, and it's true. And the number of partners that I've had to persuade to do this, and not all have the confidence, not all have the faith in the system to be able to do it, for sure. But those that do, those that go out there and start talking to vendors, start understanding their situation, start putting together win-win solutions to someone who's not done a sophisticated deal. And it sounds crazy, isn't it? So you can buy a property using none of your own money yet, and it will make you a monthly positive cash flow of, you know, a few hundred pounds, yes. And then you can refinance it and be given a chunk of money for basically buying the property, and it will keep making you a positive income forevermore. It sounds like magic, doesn't it? It sounds like impossible, but it absolutely is, because you're being paid for the value you've given to that vendor, and you get paid forevermore. And of course, it's not just the value you give to the vendor then, it's the value you give to the Airbnb guests, and then the value you give to perhaps permanent tenants that you have in properties, etc., etc. So there's a lot of people getting value from it. Of course, you're also giving value to the finance investor, who's getting a really good rate of return. And so I've seen partners who have embraced this philosophy and have cracked on with it, have found vendors who have problems to solve, have come up with solutions, and then have realized that, yes, there is always the money there. If the deal is good enough, there's always the money there. And that's part of why I've JV with so many of my partners. You know, they've got a good deal and they've not got the money ready. Well, I'll put the money in, or I'll go find an investor who will put the money in, and we'll do a JV of some kind. I've seen that work many times. I've also seen partners who haven't got that confidence. You know, for whatever reason, they want to dot the I's and cross the T's. And so what they do, and this is the worst way of doing it in my opinion, it's not impossible to make it work this way, but it's far less likely to work this way, is where they go and find a finance investor and they say, so if I find a hypothetical deal, and invariably they have to explain a deal. So if they've not done one, explaining what might come up. And it's very hard. Even now I struggle to explain hypothetical deals to people. In fact, I was talking to a really high net worth individual. Massive company, 200 staff. He's the sole owner. It's a limited company, owns every single share, earns a great deal of money. I think his company now trades on 4 continents. And he wants to get into investing, and he wants to do sophisticated investing. He doesn't want to do a few armchair investments. He wants to put high 6 figures into his portfolio this year, and he wants that to work really hard for him. And he was asking me to describe a typical deal. Well, the problem is I can describe 100 typical deals, because they're all atypical, they're all different. And what I was trying to get across to him was, because what he wants to do is agree on a type of deal, and then me go and find 10 of them this year and 10 of them next year, and for him to leave it to his team. So I've sat down with he and his FD, and we've talked about what would work for them and what wouldn't. And I know I can bring them brilliant deals that they'll be delighted with, but trying to put them into a box before I found the vendor is really hard. In fact, I'd say almost impossible. So you describe to them a great deal, and then you bring them a great deal, but it looks very different to the one you describe to them. And then they're uncomfortable, because they just got their head around and spent sometimes a few hours, because these are sophisticated deals. They've spent a few hours understanding the example, and you've talked them through it, and then you show them something that doesn't resemble it at all. And that's the nature of sophisticated deals. So I've had 3 conversations with this guy now, And I honestly don't think, things might change, but I don't think we're going to do business together. I don't think I'm going to find him any deals. And we like each other. I've got a great product for him. I can help him in building his portfolio. He's got money to invest. He's a smart guy. I like to think I know what I'm doing. And so everything should work. But because of the nature of our product, because, you know, sophisticated investments all look so, so different. That's the reason we've done it as a franchise, because that support for 5 years for every single transaction that our franchisees come across is critical. If we condensed it into a very expensive 6-month training program, the problem is after the 6 months, every deal that the client would find would be slightly different or very different to what we trained them on, and that would be really hard for them to work out how to monetize it. And so there are partners that I've seen that have tried to go and get the money and line it all up and then have found the vendors, but invariably the vendor doesn't quite fit the money. Whereas if you find a really good vendor and then go to people with money, they get it. They go, oh yeah, I can see this vendor situation, you know, this is why this person, here's Mrs. Smith, and this is what she's trying to achieve. And look, if we help her to achieve this in this way, we can make this money. This is how the deal's structured. They can get their head around it. They can bounce it off their solicitors. They can sleep on it, and then they can take action. And so I do think that's the best way of doing it, Amanda. And I think, unfortunately, people get hung up on it. People get hung up on the fact that they don't, you know, have 10 people with £1 million each in their bank account in their phone. And the reality is you don't need anywhere near that much money. You know, you might need... well, you might need no one in your phone, or if you find the right deal, you might realize that there's actually 500 grand in your phone. You just didn't know it existed until you had a deal and started talking to people about it. But there's no point talking hypothetically. It's much better to speak in definite terms. I have this vendor. This is what I can pay you in order to help them. Are you interested? And you know, you can have 10 or 20 of those phone calls in a morning and source the money you need. And people might be thinking, as they're listening to this, they might be thinking, yeah, but I wouldn't be confident enough. Well, believe me, you are confident enough when you have a vendor who sat there and said, yeah, if I can just pay, sometimes it's as little as £1,000. If I can just pay £1,000 next week, then yes, I can sell my house to you at 70% of what it's worth. Like, who can't find £1,000 in the next week in order to make 30 grand in the next 5 weeks? And of course we all can. We all have someone we can call on. I'll make the offer now. If anyone leaves a comment in the podcast that says, I've got a vendor, the deal's arranged, I need £1,000 in order to buy it at £30,000 below market value, or 30% below market value, then yeah, I'll happily joint venture and we'll make that happen. And so there's always opportunities there, for sure.
I had a very similar situation with a vendor who had a hole in his roof, hadn't got £100 to repair it, but it meant that I could buy the property at 30% below market value. So I paid the £100 to get his roof repaired, because it made total sense for me to invest that to get that deal across the line. So it is all about that mindset and making it work.
And that sounds incredible. But of course, it won't be just because he's got a £100 hole in his roof. He will have had other reasons for wanting to sell. But what got him over the line, you know, the last straw, if you like, was the fact that you could just solve his roof there and then for him and get it fixed in the next couple of days, before you've bought the house, before the solicitors have exchanged contracts, etc. And that's the thing about helping vendors. It genuinely is, how can we help them? Not, well, we might lose our £100 if we do it before completion. And that mindset is one of scarcity, which doesn't lead to loads of deals. Yeah.
What would be the main reason that you wouldn't bridge a deal like the one that you've purchased and you've now refinanced and got your 10k cash back?
I don't look at this as a bridge. In fact, I've only ever used bridging, let me get this right, I want to say once, but I might have used it another time. It might have been twice, but I honestly don't think I've ever used bridging three times. So I'm not a big fan of it. And the main reason, and some of my clients have used it loads to great success, but the main reason is I'm risk averse. And so if I'm buying something, I want it to be cash flow positive from day one. If it's cash flow negative, then that's really risky. A mentor of mine used to say cash flow negative cash flow brings me out in hives. And I think that's a good way of thinking about it. You know, anything cash flow negative, you should have a really adverse reaction to it, because it's bad news in property. And you only have to listen to Robert Kiyosaki or any of the leaders in real estate investing education. And they all talk about, you know, Dolph DeRoos, for example, talks about cash flow being the absolute most important thing in your property investing business. And so I don't look on this as bridging. I know people look at it and go, of course it was private finance, and then you've refinanced off it. Well, for starters, it was quite a long-term bridge. You want to look at it that, you know, it's way over a year. In fact, it might even be over 2 years. And so I had it on that bridge, in inverted commas, or that personal finance for a fair old while. But the reason I had it on for such a long time is because it didn't matter to me, because it was still cash flow positive. And so when would I not use bridging? Well, I think if we flip that around, when would I use bridging? When the bridging cost, whatever it may be, and I've seen costs from 0.8% a month, I'm talking about commercial bridging now, 0.8% a month all the way up to 1.5% a month. In fact, I've lent money on to someone recently, which would be a private bridge, and I think I charged them 1% a month for the first 2 months, 2% a month for the next 2 months, and 3% a month thereafter. Well, that's really, really expensive bridging, and it's because they said they only needed it for 4 weeks. And I know from experience that that might extend and become longer. And I wanted them, as motivated as I was, to get that money back into my account. So we agreed to structure that way. So bridging can be really expensive. And let's just on that, by the way, they did the deal and they've repaid 80% of that loan already within about 6 weeks. And that's brilliant. They managed to do the deal and they made sure that I was repaid really quickly, so that they didn't go on to the higher interest rate. Then, you know, the 20% might go on to the higher interest rate while they pay that back. But the only way that I want, that I will feel comfortable doing a deal, is on the day that I buy it, it makes me money. And so I was happy to do this deal because it made me money from day one. And then after I'd refinanced, it made me even more money. Plus I had the cash back. If it was going to lose me money from day one on a bridge, then I'd think really carefully about it. And unless it was a slam dunk, you know, few hundred pounds negative and then tens of thousands of pounds profit, I think I'd be walking away. I just, you know, there are so many deals out there, Amanda, as you know. It's not worth squeezing a deal and trying to make something work that's likely to lose you money and tying up cash in it and spending time on it, etc. You may as well just pass on that one, pass on the one that's going to be negative cash flow, that's going to take on the risky bridging, and go buy one that doesn't require any bridging or does take bridging but is going to be cash flow positive from day one. I think that's just so much better.
You mentioned here that you had a private investor loaned you the money for this purchase, and you had that for a considerable amount of time. And if you consider what banks are offering at the moment, sort of less than 1% typically, what are your investors typically getting as a return on lending?
Once again, every deal is different, but the lowest I ever pay is 5% interest. And that's what our Stepping Stones Housing Fund pays as well, 5% interest. That's our FCA accredited fund. And so that's the lowest. If I'm doing it privately, you know, with an investor, then it will be typically unsecured. Sometimes it's secured, depends on the deal again. And then the highest I've ever paid, I have paid 1% a month. I don't think I've ever paid above 1% a month. If I'm honest, I'm not too comfortable at 10%. And so it's typically between 5 and 10%. And then it depends on the deal. It depends on the investor. You know, if I've got an investor that really wants a higher rate and I've got a deal that can pay a higher rate, then great. If I've got an investor that just says, you know, have it for 5 years, I mean, no, you know, I'm just delighted. I'm getting 50 times what I'm getting in the bank. You know, if someone's getting 0.1% in the bank and you can offer them 5%, you're giving them 50 times the return. And it's very easy to look at it and go, well, I should give them 1% then, because that's 10 times the return, or 0.5%. But I look at it and I think, I can make good money off 5%. And so let's be generous about it. If that's a win for me, let's make it a win for the investor, and they're more likely to tell their friends and family. You know, if you have delighted clients, then the next time you've got something for them, they're going to jump at the opportunity.
Has there ever been a property in this situation that you've been unable, you've just looked at and you've just been unable to solve the problem?
I'm struggling to think of an exact, like a precise example. I'm sure there are many. I don't think it's that we haven't necessarily been able to find a solution. In fact, I've just thought of one where we couldn't find a solution. But I think of the hundreds that there are where we've made an offer and it's been declined, you could say we've not found a solution there. Now, we will, in 99.9% of cases, have put a solution together that solves the vendor's problem, in our opinion, whether that's, you know, they need to liquidate cash or they need to avoid repossession or whatever it might be. Maybe sometimes it's compliance, you know, some council or government body are stepping in to buy the property or take control of it, and unless they take swift action. And so the solution that we've given to them that they've rejected means that it doesn't work for them, and often those people will come back to us, but not always. Sometimes they solve it in another way. So have we failed to find a solution there? I think we probably have. We've failed to find a win-win solution, but I'm okay with that, because I propose what I think is a win-win solution. You've, using Stephen Covey's language, if you go into a lose-win solution where you're going to lose because you've made the deal too good for the vendor, then that's not great, because you're not going to be able to help lots of vendors. If you start losing money on deals, you're going to run out of money and not be able to help more vendors. So I strive to propose a win-win, and the vendors that want to then accept that solution will do so, and those that don't will walk away. And I think that's just a good balance, really. Two examples spring to mind. So the first was a property. I think it was grade one listed. It was in Burton upon Trent. I remember it well. And I drove past it a few months ago, actually, and thought, oh, that was the one. And it's the only property I've never offered on. We pride ourselves on being able to solve every property problem and offer on every property. But I couldn't justify even paying a pound for this property. And it was on the pavement, so it fronted the pavement. It was a very old property. I think it was grade one listed. It had a tree growing out of the roof, as in the roof had collapsed, and there was a tree. And this tree was probably 4 or 5 inches diameter, so a proper tree. There were no rooms, so to speak. It was just like a shell of a building. The tiles were all loose. The guy wouldn't let me in it because he said, like, I won't accept the liability of, you know, if you get hurt. And so I just had to walk around the outside, and I looked at it and I thought, even at a pound, it's listed, which, you know, probably quadruples the cost of any works, because you have to get everything approved and get, you know, all the materials that they dictate, rather than, you know, your normal run-of-the-mill materials, etc. And your tradespeople are more expensive because you're using old-fashioned materials in some cases, etc. So I thought, any works are going to be really expensive. There's massive works to do. I can't properly quantify them because I can't get in. And the risk of litigation from a claim against me as the owner was massive, because if the part of the roof had fallen onto the pavement or part of the building had fallen onto the pavement, then you're liable, aren't you? I couldn't justify him even just giving it to me. I thought it was more of a liability than an asset. And so I couldn't offer, and he wanted, I think, money for it. I think he wanted good money, because in his eyes it was a property. But that's the only one that I can ever remember, and that's years ago. That's the only one I remember not actually offering on. So I think you could say, yeah, I've failed there. Thinking about it now, would I be able to solve it now? And this is the thing, you know, each year that goes by, I think we get more creative and more sophisticated and more able to solve problems. think I'd have a better probability now. I think I'd probably leave it in his name, leave the liability with him, and do some kind of exchange or delay completion whereby we did works until it was up to a safe standard and then we bought it from him. I think I'd do something like that, but at the time I didn't know how to mitigate our liability. So I think that actually, come to think of it, I'm thinking, yeah, that would be quite a good solution. And he may well still own it. I should probably go back to him because I can't see anyone else buying it. The other example is a recent one, and a very well-known property trainer contacted me through our marketing. I think he saw an advert of ours, and he contacted me, and this property was massive. I think it was a 52-bed, something like that, HMO. But it had a prohibition order on it, and it had all kinds of issues with it. It didn't have planning for HMOs, so it was vacant and had been for quite some time. And it was cash flow negative to the tune of something like £4,000 a month on bridging, quite expensive bridging. He actually, his opening line was, look, I don't want the headache of this. The council don't like me. I've tried a few things, but I think a fresh face will be able to solve this, no problem. Of course, that's, you know, playing to my ego because I like solving property problems. You know, he's a very successful investor. And so he's going to know a thing or two about property negotiations. I think a more naive investor or a less experienced investor would have gone, oh, yeah, I've got time and energy. You know, he was saying, oh, I'm a bit busy, etc. And he basically said, you can have it for a pound. I'll give you a lease option on it for a pound. All you have to do is cover the £4,000 a month negative cash flow, whack a planning permission in, you know, put 50 people in, look at the cash flow you can make, blah, blah, blah. And I looked at it. It had, a prohibition order on it, been declined planning. It was a dog of a building. And as you know, we love those. We love properties that no one else knows what to do with. But that's not to the point of stupidity, you know, where there is nothing you can do. And so I did make him an offer, and the offer was, I'll work for free on this. I do think I can solve it. I do think I can get planning permission. I do think I can monetize it in the meantime. I had a commercial application for it that we could use, because planning on that could take a year, without many complications. And so I said, I think I can monetize it in this way. And I told him how I thought I could monetize it in the short term. I was going to use storage, use it as self-storage. I thought there was a market for it in that area, and it lent itself to that really easily. So I said, yeah, I'll run it as self-storage. I'll bring someone in to run it. We'll go 50-50. On all cash flow. So any profits we make go 50-50 on it. At the same time, we'll apply for planning. We'll get planning for it as this 52 bedrooms. And then we'll run it as a JV moving forwards, 50-50 JV. However, until it's profitable, I want you to cover the £4,000 because I don't know all the intricacies, etc. So it's going to take me time. I'm going to put loads of time and effort in, and it's going to take a few months for us to get positive cash flow. And I thought that was a win-win, because if he truly believed that it was salvageable and he hadn't bought something that was a lemon, and he spent, you know, a year or 2 years or whatever. Yeah, and so the proof of the pudding was the fact that he wasn't willing to cover the £4,000 a month, despite there was all the upside there for him. He was really just looking to get rid of that liability for the £4,000 a month by signing a lease option, which, you know, is, or an exchange of delay completion. So yeah, was that a failure on our part? I don't think so, actually. I think actually what I proposed was a win-win, but he didn't want to go for it. And that's fine. That's his prerogative. So do we help every vendor? No, not at all. In fact, we're looking for the 1 in 1,000 vendors whom we can help. But being able to help a vendor, part of that is them recognizing that we're able to help them.
Would you be able to sort of give us a description of what typically makes a property unmortgageable?
Condition. So not, if we talk about buy-to-let mortgages, to keep it simple, not being able to get a mortgage on a property, it boils down to, is it rentable? And the bar can be surprisingly high. You know, I've had properties with tenants in them, happily paying rent, and the valuer has come out and said, no, it's not in a lettable condition, which begs the question, you know, what's a lettable condition? If surely the definition is a tenant paying rent. But what they're looking at as a lender is, if that tenant moves out, would another tenant be readily sort, you know, would another tenant happily move in? So it has to be in a decent condition. And decoration, you know, are the walls painted and is the wallpaper in good condition? That, normally that's okay, but valuers can be very fickle and lenders can be very fickle. And of course, they're putting pressure on valuers in different ways, depending on their preferences and their willingness to lend. Definitely kitchens and bathrooms need to be functional and serviceable, etc. For obvious reasons, you know, if there's no kitchen, it's unmortgageable because it's uninhabitable. If there's no bathroom, the same. And then some unusual ones, this catches a lot of people out, having two kitchens in a property. Two kitchens often will make a property unmortgageable, and it sounds odd, but it's because they're then looking at it as two properties. And, you know, a larger house can have a kitchenette on another floor or whatever, but the lenders tend to not like that at all. So always watch out for that. And in fact, I've had to take kitchens out of property in order to make them mortgageable. And then it's the normal stuff. Any sign of subsidence, often they'll either decline to lend or they'll ask for a surveyor's report. And if the surveyor's report isn't favourable, then they'll deem it unmortgageable. Rot in property, damp in properties, roofs, you have to look out for roofs. So any structural issues that aren't easily resolved. And it's interesting because damp can be resolved fairly cheaply normally. You know, if you're talking about £200,000 property, often you can resolve damp issues for £2,000, £3,000, £4,000. So it's a relatively minor fix. But often they'll do 100% retention, which means they say, yeah, we will lend on it, but we'll only lend once you've fixed the damp, which doesn't really seem sensible, because why not just lend £190,000 and then say we'll release the final £10,000 when you've fixed the damp? I have had properties where they've done, you know, they've retained some of the funds like that and said, until you've done these works, we're going to hold this back. And so long as they lend enough, you can do the deal and then you can do the works afterwards. But if the works need doing first because they're doing 100% retention, for example, then that's where some of the sophisticated strategies like key undertakings, where you do the works while the vendor owns the property, come into play then and make those deals possible, when ordinarily people would be thinking, well, I haven't got enough cash to buy it, so I can't do the deal. So there are often solutions to get a property mortgageable before you buy it.
What about construction, Frank? I know that sometimes properties that were perhaps built just post-war because there was a shortage of property, some of the construction is a little bit questionable, but they've stood the test of time clearly, because they're still standing and they're still habitable. But I know lenders can be a little bit cautious about actually lending on properties with unusual constructions.
There's quite a few, actually. So it's ironic. Timber frame was always frowned upon by lenders. And yet, if you look at Grand Designs, nearly every property is now timber frame. So I think the tide's turning on that one. But yeah, there are some really old construction methods that lenders don't like. But typically, you can find that out really easily. And so you can, you know, look up a construction. If it's a non-standard construction, then you can look it up and sort it out. You can look it up and find out whether there's a remedy. Often there is. You know, you can clad a building, or you can do something to it, or it might just be unmortgageable, and that means you can't get lending on it.
Frank, I think it's been really insightful, the information that you've shared with us, and I'm sure that our listeners will be hugely grateful for the information that you've given to us today. I'm sure everybody will be looking forward to the next Sophisticated Saturday and the next podcast.
Thanks, Amanda. Great to chat.
That was the Sophisticated Property Investing Podcast from Ethical Property Partners. Use your podcast app to follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.